I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Election night 2016 was a cliffhanger until Pennsylvania and two other Rust Belt states took Donald Trump over the finish line. Those results defied the conventional wisdom at the time and the predictions from pundits and pollsters. Our guest Ben Bradley Jr. decided to find out how this brash billionaire was able to win over so many working class voters. He went to Luzerne County in Pennsylvania that had been a reliable Democratic stronghold for years, had voted for Barack Obama twice, and fell hard for Trump. Bradley profiles a dozen Trump supporters in his new book, The Forgotten. They felt abandoned by the Democratic Party. They despised Hillary Clinton and believed that Trump spoke their language and expressed their frustrations about the country and the quality of their lives. Ben Bradley Jr. was a reporter and editor at the Boston Globe for 25 years, oversaw the paper's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation into Catholic clergy abuse in the Boston area, the subject of the Oscar-winning movie Spotlight. He joins us for this special edition of Radio Times with a full house of WHYY members and supporters. Ben Bradley Jr., nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
I would love to read with the beginning, from the beginning of the book, where you, in a sense, encapsulate the Trump supporters that you interviewed and talked to.
Okay. Each one of these people is different, but their lives share common themes. They have a contempt for Washington and the powers that be, who they feel have mostly abandoned them and left them marginalized by flat or falling wages, rapid demographic change, and a dominant liberal culture that mocks their faith and patriotism. They feel like everyone else is punching bag and that their way of life is dying. They sense a loss of dignity and stature. They feel as though others are cutting in line and that government is taking too much money from the employed and giving it to the able-bodied idle. They feel that government regulations have become strangling in small and large businesses, and that the country is in danger of being inundated by immigrants, legal and illegal.
Were you one of those people that were either shocked or surprised by the election results, November 2016?
Totally shocked. And I had been watching Trump, well, like everybody. He emerged in 2015 from the Republican PAC. He had 16 opponents. We forget it was that many.
Yep.
In the Republican primary, who he steamrolled, and he assigned each one of them demeaning nicknames, warming up to face Crooked Hillary in the general election. And this was the most unusual presidential candidate we've ever seen. This guy said and did things that would have destroyed any other candidacy for president. But for some reason, he had Teflon, and he connected with a broad segment of the electorate. And I was looking for a way to write about this in a different way. And combing through the election results in the three critical Rust Belt states, I discovered this county in Pennsylvania, Northeast Pennsylvania, only 2 hours from here, drive, thereabouts, and the Luzerne County, where Wilkes-Barre is, and Hazleton. And this is a traditionally Democratic county. Hadn't voted for a Republican for president since 1988, Bush Sr. Obama had carried the county twice, but it surged in the other direction for Trump in 2016. And he built up such a margin in this one county that it turned out to be 60% of his victory margin in Pennsylvania. He won Pennsylvania by 44,000 votes, and 26,000 of those came from Luzerne County, or about 60%. So I went down there. I drove down within a month after the election and began interviewing Trump voters with a view to doing a deep dive, so to speak, into the Trump phenomenon and using this county as a window to do so.
Well, the book is filled with quotes of people that you interviewed. A man who I believe works as a prison guard quoted in this book saying, "Donald Trump makes me feel good about myself and who I am. Hillary makes me apologize if I want to hunt and I don't have a college education." He didn't like the fact that the district was often described as uneducated white voters. I would hear TV pundits use that phrase all that time. That was attacking the dignity of the people that go to work every day, and he goes on from there. Mm-hmm. How strong and how common was that sentiment? They felt looked down on.
Yes, it was widespread. They felt isolated, as the passage said, sort of condescended to by elites on either coast. You look at a map of the country, county by county, on election night, and it looks like a landslide for Trump. Sea of red. With only blue pockets on either coast. And, you know, I come from Boston, and Massachusetts, of course, is a deep blue state. Philadelphia proper, I guess, is blue, certainly.
But pretty dark blue, actually.
Dark blue.
Yes.
But we forget we live in these, bubbles. And for me, I really learned a lot, spending a lot of time with these voters. And even though they like Trump a lot still, I think they too lament how polarized we are, mm-hmm. and are looking for some way to have dialogue with the other side.
Well, I know that what you did was to listen, something that I think many of us sometimes forget to do. Were you able to listen without judgment?
I think so. This really is, somebody coined the phrase listening reporting, and I think it's important to get to the ground truths of people's lives. And I mostly let them talk about themselves, would gently correct, blatant factual errors without trying to inject myself too much and without being condescending. Because they really feel that. And their antennae are up for that. And they were, I think, suspicious of me coming from Massachusetts and said, "Oh, you're a liberal." You know, I would get a lot of that. But then like anything else, as a journalist, you get a foot in the door and you establish rapport with these people and they begin to trust you.
And when you mean foot in the door, were you talking to them over their kitchen tables or in their living rooms? Or?
Yes, initially, and then many follow-up interviews. I would go back and forth, and sometimes by phone as well. And,
I do want to play a clip, and this is then-candidate Donald Trump. He's at a campaign rally. This is in Wilkes-Barre in 2016.
Your jobs will come back under a Trump administration, that I can tell you. That I can tell you. Including your steel, which has been decimated in this area. Once the proud champion, your steel has been decimated, and we know all about the games where China's dumping all over the place. They're dumping steel. Your steel will come back. Your energy will be protected. It will be a whole different ballgame for it. We will no longer be the dumb people. We'll be the genius people, believe me.
That's the language they understood.
Yeah. They related to him in ways that they did not relate to Hillary Clinton.
They despised Hillary Clinton.
Well, they didn't like her. Her famous line about the deplorables was not helpful.
No.
And they flipped that and started wearing T-shirts. "I'm a proud deplorable," you know. And they say you can fall in love with your therapist to the extent that he or she makes you feel listened to. And I think these voters felt that Trump was listening to them and that Hillary largely wrote them off.
It's always interested me that this would be, of course, in the primary, we're reliving history here, that these would be the kind of people that might like a Bernie Sanders or Bernie Sanders himself, because in many ways he spoke about the same thing, the same frustrations with the system, the feeling left out of whatever success there certain members of this country are enjoying.
Right.
What was it about Trump, though, that you think really spoke to them?
Well, there was some overlap between the Trump constituency and Bernie Sanders constituency. And Trump voters would talk about him in positive ways to a certain extent. But then they would say, well, he's a communist, and how can you vote for a communist? And he looks like a crazy uncle that came out of the attic. And, you know, Trump was just...
he wasn't your
he
crazy
spoke
uncle?
Their language. Well, I mean, he's the, you know, they call him the blue-collar billionaire. You know, he obviously was totally privileged, and but he connected with them, and he was a... For someone who had never run for office before, it was really amazing to watch how he could politically connect with these people.
Well, I think you can see this even now with the rallies that he's been holding. When the camera's on him and you see his supporters behind him, they are thoroughly entertained.
They love it. They love it.
They're laughing.
They're laughing. They know all his lines. They finish some of his lines for him. They strike up a chorus of lock her up still. It's theater. And to me, it just goes to prove the adage that people decide their vote more on likability and how they relate to a candidate rather than where he stands on this or that issue.
You quote a guy named Marty Bacone who says, isn't that what America is now? Everything is crude and lewd and all on social media. I think people are related to that in the campaign. I don't know anyone that doesn't curse. Do you? Was it about the language?
Well, he gave them, I think a lot of his appeal was built around being politically incorrect. And PC and political correctness has become sort of a trope. But I think this did have a lot of appeal. Trump was constantly hovering over the line of respectability and things that you could say and things that you couldn't say. And he gave people, when he pushed the envelope constantly and said things that no other presidential candidate had said, he gave people license to say things that they had bottled up, too. And that was part of his appeal.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Ben Bradley Jr. He's got a new book called The Forgotten, How the People of One Pennsylvania County Elected Donald Trump and Changed America, that county being Luzerne. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen with a full house of WHYY members and supporters. You can probably hear them. And we are here to hear Ben Bradley Jr. talk about his interviews, his experiences talking to Trump supporters in Luzerne County, the subject of his new book called The Forgotten. You mentioned politically incorrect. How much do you think race, even racism, was appealing to Trump supporters?
I think it was a factor. I think it was under the radar. Trump, don't forget, rose to political prominence on the strength of the birther movement. He championed that, and he had to have known it was a lie. But he kept it up and kept it up, and only reluctantly, towards the end of the campaign, was forced to abandon it, but never apologized to Obama.
So he said something like, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, he was pushing that, and that was what first vaulted him to prominence within the Republican Party. And then there was Charlottesville, and his core issue, illegal immigration, of course, had racial undertones. And Luzerne County has had a surge in Hispanic people moving in, particularly in the city of Hazleton, which is the second city in the county. And within the last 10 years alone, it's become a majority-minority city, mostly Dominicans moving in from New York, New Jersey, for lower cost of housing, et cetera. So all of this created a racial undertone.
You interviewed a woman named Jess Harker. Her husband actually is not a Trump supporter, but she is, and she's pretty much a diehard supporter. But she said about Obama that in Obama, Democrats elected a community organizer, Saul Alinsky, radical, and she goes on from there. I believe Obama is a Muslim.
Yeah. I mean, that sentiment still exists, and that you have to try to point out that that's no, he's not a Muslim. He organized Christian prayer breakfasts and so forth. But people who were suspicious of him as too exotic, they still had that underlying he's not us kind of feeling.
Let me play another clip, and this is actually a woman named Lynette Villano, who you interview. She's a former Luzerne County delegate for Donald Trump. In fact, she was on Radio Times. This was January 2017. We did a show after the election. We did a follow-up show with several Trump supporters. Let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about Lynette Villano.
It starts with jobs, because if you have a job, then maybe you can buy a house, take care of your family, so, get health care, especially the kids that are going to college and they have these high debt and these bills to pay and they can't get jobs. And so I think maybe that is like one of the number one issues.
The number one issue being jobs. How did you find Lynette? I guess we all found Lynette, right?
Yeah. Well, she was, I learned about her just asking around Luzerne County, and she was one of the most prominent Trump supporters. And she would learn to, I wrote in the book, I think she would find herself dealing with skeptical journalists, perhaps, or other Trump detractors, and she would learn, I wrote, to spin like an amateur Kellyanne Conway. And she loved that. She said, "That's the nicest thing somebody has ever said about me." One of the most interesting things about Lynette was that she illustrated how this election and Trump came between families. And she has a heartbreaking story about how the relationship with her grandson was fractured by Trump. Lynette, you remember Trump's famous quote during the election that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and still not lose any votes? Well, that's Lynette. And the day after the election, she texted her grandson, who then was a senior at Tulane University. She texted him about how happy she was that Trump had got elected. And then the kid just went off. He couldn't stand Trump, and he thought that Trump's election was one of the worst things that had ever happened in the country. And she shared with me these series of texts, which I reprinted verbatim in the book, because they perfectly illustrate the philosophical divide that still exists in this country over Trump.
Well, let me read just a couple of things where Lynette says to her grandson, Connor, I've saved America. I'm very proud. It's your future that kept me strong and made me work even harder. She goes on from there. Connor writes back, you didn't save America. You damned it. Trump goes against core American values, and you bought into his race baiting. You keep lying to yourself, and you think the people want Trump, but he lost the popular vote, and it goes from there. Is there still a rift in this family over the 2016 election?
Yeah, they've not reconciled.
They don't talk to each other?
They've not reconciled. And it's been made a little worse by the book, frankly, because...
there it is, right?
There it is, yeah.
Till the day I die, I will stand by my decision to work for and help Donald Trump, she says to her grandson. But I thought it also encapsulated, as you mentioned, so where we stand as a country, that we really are, in many ways, in very different camps, viewing the world in very different ways and having very different opinions about the president.
Yeah, and we're so polarized. We were, in fairness to Trump, we were polarized as a country before the election, but I think he's made it worse. He behaves mostly as president of his base rather than president of the entire country. On election night in victory, he did extend an olive branch and said it's time to unite. But he's done nothing of the sort as president to try and help unite the country. He goes off and he continues to have these... within 2 weeks of being elected, he had his first rally, and he continues to have these rallies mm-hmm. in red states or pockets where he knows he's very popular. And he says... You know, each morning there's a tweet storm. He bashes. He's not conciliatory. And I wonder, looking ahead in 2020, if there is not political hay to be made by a Democrat who would run on a platform of trying to unite the country more than we are. Because as I said earlier...
It would be nice.
Even the Trump people lament the chasm and wonder how we could start talking to each other again, but they don't know how to do it. And this is a question of leadership, pure and simple. It's presidential leadership.
Help us understand, and I guess I'm asking you to get into the mind of a Trump supporter, but you did interview them. That when the president says things that are not true, he promised earlier this week that before the election there would be a 10% middle class tax cut. That is not going to happen. He said there are riots in California over sanctuary cities. Not true. The Middle Eastern people have infiltrated the caravan coming up through Central America. Apparently not true either. When he's, and the Washington Post has listed, I think, thousands of statements
over
that he 5, said.
Over 5,000.
In the last not even 2 years, of things that he said are patently false. Mm-hmm. How does a Trump supporter, and many of them are diehard fans, how do they process that? How do they make sense of it?
Well, Trump, this is one of the most fascinating things, I think, about Trump. He's created an alternate reality where facts are no longer facts. We have Kellyanne Conway's famous quote that there are alternative facts to
we
consider.
Didn't know that.
Don't forget about the alternative facts.
I didn't know that, yes.
And I think that that's really dangerous. You know, we used to routinely say facts are facts, and how can you dispute that? Well, facts apparently are no longer facts in this country. And, you know, the Washington Post has this fact checker column, and as you said, they've documented more than 5,000 false or misleading statements, as they're sometimes charitably called, not necessarily lies, because lies depends on intent, I suppose. But when these things are pointed out, the Trump base doesn't accept them. They think it's, well, this is just the liberal Washington Post, and it's bias, and they don't believe it. So, you know, we have... media silos in this country now. People are their own editors with Google. They go to if you're a Trump hardcore supporter, you listen to Fox News. You go to Breitbart, Drudge Report, and if you're on the left, you go to MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, or whatever it is. People. There is no trusted source anymore.
In fact, you quote a guy named Ed Harry, He says people don't believe what they hear in the news anymore for a whole bunch of reasons. I have to look at alternative sites like Drudge. I look at Breitbart. I don't get enough from what the main networks are telling me. To me, it's a propaganda machine. And he goes on from there saying, mm-hmm. I listen to Alex Jones and Michael Savage.
Yeah, yeah. Ed gets a little he gets a little conspiratorial, which is a strain in out there in the Trump base.
But your book also tells us that there's something that the Democrats did not do. I mean, Luzerne County was reliably Democratic since the first Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. But something happened, and whether it was Trump himself or were there local issues that seemed to resonate with these Trump supporters, or was it a national issue or something about Hillary or just the Democratic Party itself?
Well, Hillary was a flawed candidate, and she helped Trump a lot. You know, a lot of these people were not prepared to swallow her candidacy under any circumstances, and so that helped morph them into Trump supporters. But Trump also had, you know, an affirmative vote as well. I think, you know, you look at Trump's record so far, I think it's culture over economics. In terms of Trump's appeal, they like a lot of the things that he's done. You know, they point to mostly obvious things like the tax cut, getting two very conservative Supreme Court justices on the court. North Korea is at the negotiating table. You know, he's repealed all or most of Obama's executive orders, streamlined the bureaucracy. They point to those things. But also there are a lot of economic metrics that Trump has not delivered on, that he said he would. He said he would eliminate the deficit in 8 years. But his first budget adds $7 trillion to the deficit. He said he'd replace Obamacare and have a new health care system. That we're nowhere near that. You know, he said we'd have an infrastructure program that would create hundreds of thousands of jobs. We're nowhere near that. And there are other things too. But they don't hold that against him, really. They say that, well, if he promised that, it's just, you know, the Democrats in Congress obstructing.
You mentioned the tax plan, and the biggest beneficiaries of the tax plan are wealthy people.
Yes, yes, and corporations. Yeah.
So again, there's one thing that I think we've learned over the last couple of years, something called confirmation bias, where people tend to believe the things that they believe, and they search out the information that underscores those beliefs.
Yeah, they go to news sites that they feel comfortable with, and that's their world. And more people these days don't go out of that world, and tune in on Fox, say, to see what they're talking about there.
So, what was your biggest takeaway from spending time with? And you spent more than a year talking with people in Luzerne County.
I guess the extent of the divide. I didn't think it was as big as it was, and these people just feel a lot of it is. Psychological too, you know. A lot of these were Democrats who crossed over to vote for Trump, and they would say, "I didn't leave the Democratic Party; the Democratic Party left me." They didn't feel listened to. I think that's a key ingredient, and that Hillary, against the advice of her husband, by the way, essentially wrote off the white working class, and did take them for granted.
What would they have wanted to hear?
They would just want to feel not taken for granted and listened to. You know, I mean, a lot of this gets pretty squishy, admittedly.
Right.
But it's style, and it's time spent there. And Hillary didn't spend any time in Luzerne County.
Right. Even though she's got some roots
in that area, part of
Pennsylvania. So there was something about Trump. Was it his brashness? Was it his willingness to say almost anything, whether it was true or not?
Something that
was appealing that way?
They
style?
They like his style. I think it's style over substance. They like how he gets up in the morning and just sticks it to the press and bashes them. They like how he never apologizes, never backs down, even when he's obviously cornered and, like the birther thing.
Right.
They like it. They like his sort of populist style and how he just gives them hell.
I'm curious about what it was like to be sitting in a kitchen and hearing these conversations, what it was like for you.
Well, I talked to the probably 100 or more Trump voters, but settled on 12 who were in the book. And I chose them very subjectively, admittedly, but people who I thought represented different slices of the Trump constituency, who had interesting stories and told them well. And after spending a lot of time with these people, you can't, even if you disagree with them, you establish relationships. It's mm-hmm. just, a human connection. And I did feel...
Do you like them?
Yeah. Some of them I do like. Some of them, it's a bridge too far.
But, well, there is a white supremacist in here. Just,
yeah.
Just so our listeners.
Well, I chose him because he calls himself a white nationalist. That's an important euphemism there.
Hold on to that thought, okay. Only because we have to take a very short break. That's Ben Bradley Jr. He's got a new book. It's called The Forgotten, How the People of One Pennsylvania County Elected Donald Trump and Changed America. A special broadcast here at WHYY. We've got a room full of WHYY supporters and donors. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We've got some questions here as well. We'll be right back. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ben Bradley Jr. about his new book, The Forgotten, about the people that he interviewed in Luzerne County in Pennsylvania, a Democratic stronghold for decades that went big time for Donald Trump in 2016. Let me play another clip, and this is a Luzerne County man. He wanted to be identified only as Tom, talking with reporter Jennifer Kinney, who was there reporting this week for WHYY and for Keystone Crossroads.
Initially, I was very happy that a black man became president, Obama. I was all for it, but I hadn't voted. And then come the second term, and I see all this stuff on the news about transgenders in the bathroom and... Why is this news? Why are we talking about this? This is the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. And, even handing the Iranians all that cash on pallets, I just kept saying, what is going on with this country? Everything just seemed very backwards. So I became interested before Trump got involved. And when Trump got involved, I was like, honestly, this dude is hilarious. He is funny. He's a smartass, but he's very frank, and he keeps it real. He's not flowering his speech with a bunch of beautiful words. He's very actually not good at speaking publicly. Like, Obama's excellent at it. And he'll inspire a conservative to be like, wow, I really like what he's saying. He's very good at that. But he's also, to me, the devil. I mean, honestly. So when it was the second term where I started getting involved with politics following it. Before that, never cared.
There's a lot going on in there, yeah. In that sentence, both liking Obama and then calling him the devil, saying that he's a great flowery speaker, Donald Trump not the greatest speaker, but he ends up in the Trump camp. Mm-hmm. Does that surprise you?
Yeah. Well, there was one Democratic state senator in Luzerne, John Udichak, who told me Obama had hope and change, whereas Trump had knocked down the door and change. And these people, they were in a mood to knock over the table, break the china, and take a flyer with this guy. They knew it was risky, but they were willing to roll the dice.
Any buyer? You were there recently on a book tour. Any buyer's remorse or
not
still
in my subset
in?
Of my 12 people, 11 of them say that if the 2020 election were to be held tomorrow, they would enthusiastically vote for Trump again.
Interesting.
Only one has slipped into the undecided column.
Into the undecided.
Undecided.
Column. Interesting. Let me, we do have a room full of people, so, and we've got a bunch of questions here. One from Hillary, who says, I'm from Luzerne County. I don't share the views of the voters featured in your book. As Thanksgiving looms, how do you recommend reducing the hostility of the conversations between those with closely held and staunchly different views with the people you love the most?
Yeah.
And perhaps even Lynette and
her
grandson.
Let me set you up with Lynette. Yeah, I was going to say, for some expert advice.
Maybe not how not to do it,
but
this is powerful and in certain ways painful stuff.
Yeah, it is. And people have been dealing with this at, since Trump got elected. There's been a Thanksgiving, and you hear tales of these. I think the way most people handle it is just have a no politics rule. They don't discuss it.
Right.
And
in fact, there's a couple in here. Harker, right?
Yeah.
She's a big Trump supporter. He is not. And there's a lovely picture of them together, their arms around each other, but I guess politics off the table?
They would call it a no-fly zone. You could not talk about Trump. And it got so serious that they had to go into counseling about Trump. And that was the advice from the therapist. Don't talk about Trump.
Yeah. Maybe take a message from Mary Madeline and James Carville. I don't know.
Yeah.
Somehow maybe that works. Bill says, did you have any really nasty experiences doing your research?
No. Other than maybe being, I wouldn't call it nasty. I would call it really enlightening and educational, especially coming from a blue state, and I'm really interested in, I'm hoping that, in a small way, maybe this book might help promote dialogue between two very dug-in sides. Not sure even how, but I really learned a lot from spending all this time with these people and learning, we're a big country. And we're all Americans, and I think we should try and find a way to communicate better.
As a longtime journalist yourself, and of course the son of a longtime journalist, do you fear for journalism, or just wondering? We are very dispersed, obviously. There's a lot of very good journalism going on. There's a lot of insulting, frankly, from President Trump about journalism. Do you worry about working in this climate?
Yeah, very much so. There's a lot that you say there, but let me try to just address. First of all, there's always properly tension between a president and the press. The press is, they call it the fourth estate, and their job is to hold administrations accountable. But Trump, I think, has crossed the line when he calls the press the enemies of the American people. I mean, that is just beyond the pale. Right. We're all American. Reporters are American citizens. And but I worry about the state of journalism, especially newspapers, which are really, especially regional and local papers, which are really struggling in the internet era to survive. We're dealing now with two generations of people who've grown up with the idea that news should be free, and they're not willing to support or pay for their local newspaper. And when newspapers have lost classified ads and their whole the economy of their business has changed totally, and they're struggling to survive. They have to adapt to the internet, but when they go to put up a paywall, most of them, people aren't signing up for it. And so newspapers in the last 10 years have perhaps been forced to lay off half their staff, and investigative reporting, which is key, I think, is suffering as a result.
Well, that takes me back to your work at the Boston Globe and the Spotlight series that was so important and so groundbreaking, but I'm sure took, what, years and a team of, I mean, I saw the movie as well, a team of reporters just digging through material and research and documents and tracking people down. And there's a lot of time and effort that goes
into it. There is. I mean, there were four reporters on the Spotlight team, and today they've gone against the grain and expanded it to six, which is really counterintuitive in this climate. I think too many editors today who are worried about having just enough staff to put out the paper view investigative reporting, a team of four reporters off by themselves, as a luxury that they can no longer afford. But I think that's short-sighted, because all reader surveys show that people like that, feel it's important, and that maybe we need a new paradigm for newspapers. Maybe we can't try to be paper of record and cover every meeting and every school board gathering, and maybe we have to devote more resources to enterprise reporting. Mm. But
you do want to be at that local town meeting. Something could happen there.
Yeah, you do. You do. Mm. And I think we're already seeing the effects of not being there. I mean, a lot of papers don't even have state house bureaus anymore, city hall bureaus.
No one watching the, is it the no Hen House or the Fox?
Yeah.
I always forget which one. Jennifer says, what do you expect to change after people read this book, or do you expect change at all?
Well, I hope there would be. Again, I hope there might be more dialogue, more of an effort from people in blue America to understand red America more, and vice versa.
But you also said you don't exactly know how to make that happen. Well, is it a more interpersonal thing?
It's interpersonal, but I think it's mostly a question of presidential leadership and setting the right tone and telling the country that this is important, that we do have to unify.
But we clearly don't have a president who thinks that way.
He's not interested
in that. He is about dividing the country.
Well, he seems to be. And he's a unique politician that way. I've never seen a politician that doesn't seem interested in expanding his own base. He seems content with maintaining his base. And his favorable ratings are going up. 47% now in the most recent Wall Street Journal NBC poll. And I think he's made a calculation that he can get reelected with 45% of the vote. After all, we've had the last two out of the last three presidents, Trump and George W. Bush, were elected without the popular vote. So Trump perhaps calculates that 45% will do it, and if there's a credible third-party candidate, that would chop up the vote further. And even the Green Party and the Libertarians got 5% of the vote, which was enough to make the difference.
Tim asks, is Trump an aberration or the new normal?
I think that's an important question. I think the key question going forward is whether Trump has started a movement here, or whether this is largely based on the power of his personality and therefore a one-off. I think we'll know a lot more after the midterms. And
you're no longer at the Boston Globe. Left?
Oh, I left quite a long time ago. Right. I spent far too long writing a biography of Ted Williams, which was a labor of love, but it took me much longer than it should have. This one I had to pretend I was on deadline.
Do you miss, though, the daily grind of a newspaper?
Not much.
No? You truly were done with it?
Particularly in this day and age when it's so unhealthy. I'm having a good time writing books.
And was there ever a future for you that was not journalism? And I guess I ask that knowing that your dad, Ben Bradley, senior of Washington Post fame.
Yeah, no, definitely. I kind of fell into it, frankly. I was in the Peace Corps out of college in Afghanistan, of all places.
And this was the early 70s.
Yeah, right? Early 70s. And my boss happened to be an editor of a small paper in California. And I got friendly with him, and he said, why don't you come out and work for me? And he, I'd grown up in Boston and wanted to experience a different part of the country, moved to California, and I'm glad I did. I mean, it's a really important state where things tend to happen first. And so I went out to Riverside, California, which is 50 miles east of L.A., smog capital of the world. And, got my feet wet and stayed in it and came back to the hometown paper, the Boston Globe, eventually.
So you grew up in Boston or the Boston area?
Yes. Yeah.
And what did you think of the movie Spotlight?
Pretty good movie, wasn't it?
I thought so. Got some Oscars, right?
Well, it was so such a surprise to us at how it happened. We had the story. We had broken the story, which took off like no story we ever could imagine in terms of the impact. And then 5 or 6 years went by, and these two young women, relatively inexperienced Hollywood producers, show up at the Globe and say, we love that story, and how you guys broke it, we want to do a movie. And, frankly, we didn't take them very seriously. But we talked to them, and they went away for like 5 or 6 years, getting nothing but doors slammed in their face in Hollywood. You know, like, who wants to make a movie about reporters and a topic as distasteful as sexual abuse? And but finally, I guess the way these things do, the financing came together. They got a good director and a good screenwriter and a A-list ensemble cast, and it was good. And they made investigative reporting, which is mostly working the phones and combing through records, look interesting.
Yes, even exciting.
Even exciting, yeah.
And
there was no sex, and there was no car chases, and it was good stuff.
Well, it was good stuff. And Ben Bradley Jr., thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And his new book is called The Forgotten, How the People of One Pennsylvania County Elected Donald Trump and Changed America. Our thanks to our members and donors here. The enthusiastic applause, greatly appreciated. Engineers Diana Martinez, Adam Stanishevsky, Joyce Lieberman, and Mike Villers. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.